Accession number 29894, reel number 3.
Elizabeth Small, reel 3. You're now going to tell me about your joining up, volunteering.
Yes. I arrived in London. I knew nothing about London at all, other than having visited and gone to the Tower of London and this sort of thing. But I didn't know where Oxford Street was or Regent Street or anything, but I had found where there was an employment agency, and it was somewhere at the top of Regent Street. And I went there by taxi, and it was rather a depressing place and a depressing lady there, and I walked in and I said, I wish to enroll, I want to be a Wren, I've got my diploma, secretarial diploma, and I speak a little French. I don't know that I said a little, possibly I said I speak French. Lie. But she said, well, you can't go in the Wrens. There's no room. And that was a dreadful shock. It never occurred to me that that was a possibility. You can be a cook in the ATS. I said, I don't want to be a cook in the ATS. There are perhaps vacancies in the WAF, but I'm not sure. But nothing in the Wrens. So that absolutely stymied me. I couldn't think of anything at all. So then she peered through some papers and she said, there is a... you say you've got a secretarial course. I said, that's my diploma and those are my... that's my education, my CV. And she said, well, there's something here asking for secretary speaking French. And I said, what is that? She said, it's called the Inter-Services Research Bureau. And I said, what is that? She said, I don't know. So, stymied again. Well, she said, they're only very near in Baker Street. Would you like me to ring them up? So I said, well, I haven't... Well, where is Baker Street? And she said, well, it's fairly near, but you'll have to take another taxi if you don't know. Could have walked, but I didn't know. So she said, I'll ring. So she rang. And she said, if you go around, someone will give you an interview. So I said, thank you. And I took a taxi. Hate taxis, always have done. Don't know how much to tip, hadn't much money. Was beginning to get that my plan, my wonderful plan, was going quite wrong. Anyway, 64 Baker Street was where I had to go, and I had to go round the back to get in, and there were sandbags all round it. And so I walked in and they said, will you wait here? So I waited, and as I waited I saw people in uniform, not only army but WAF, coming in and out, and I thought, well, it must have something to do with the war, because I'm not, otherwise I'm not interested, and all I want to do is get home, and this is stupid. So I sat, and then they said, well, will you come up? I think, but I may be wrong, anyway, she's certainly dead. Miss Furze will see you. So Miss Furze was in an office which was very bare, didn't give any indication, as of her desk and papers, and not anything very much in it. She was a civilian. She was about, I don't know, 40, so appeared rather old to me.
How do you spell her name, sir?
I think it was F-U-R-S-E. But there again, query. It's some things come back and some things you can't remember. Isn't it strange? Anyway, she took my CV and... she said, Well, we have something here which I can't tell you anything about, except that you would find it very interesting. French is essential. You would work long hours, 6 days a week, sometimes seven. I can't give any indication about leave. And the salary would be £5 a week. Well, that sounded enormous to me. I'd never had a salary. So she said, would that appeal to you? And I said, I don't know. I suppose so. I obviously have to go back to my family and speak to them. Oh, she said, yes, of course. You'll go along. You know London. And I said, I don't know London at all. She said, well, get another taxi and go back to Euston. And if we're interested, we'll get in touch with you in about a week. Good afternoon. So that was that. And, of course, I got back home. My father, by that... Now, we were into 1943, so Manchester had been bombed. The mill had been closed because there was no raw cotton to supply the mills. Only five mills were kept open, and my father's was shut. And if anything killed him, that did. He was given 1 week's notice. A postcard was sent to say, your mill will close within a week and there'll be no raw cotton. We can't get it brought in. And it was the unfairness which killed him, because there was a cotton control board, and there was the usual hokey-pokey that other mills that were not doing very well, some of them were going to get cotton, but the one like Father's, which had diversified so that it could go into uniforms and things like that, and was doing well, was shot. And that's what that killed him. He had the most massive stroke soon after. Anyway, that is how we were at home, and what I was going back to. And my mother was a wonderful woman, absolutely wonderful. She was so brave and so cheerful, and she was in the Red Cross, and she was busy doing parcels for prisoners of war. And then, of course, the cook and the housemaid had been called up, and Mother had to have someone in the house, because although Father had recovered, he couldn't be left. And a dear Scottish lady who'd been a nurse, nanny, a friend to a family, a doctor's family in the town, and was at almost retiring age, she came, and she lived with us, and she could look after Father. My brother, the only brother, was in the Middle East. There was just me back with my diploma, and of course I then had to admit that I had gone to join up, which I felt awful about, because the situation was really drastic at home. And I said, well, and my father, who was a businessman and a Lancashire man that called a spade a spade, he said, what do you mean you've gone to a job and they don't know, can't tell you anything about it? How ridiculous. You can't do something. And where would it be? Oh, I'd forgotten to say. It would be in London, in Baker Street. And he said, but the place has just been it's had the bombing. But I said, nobody's to worry or anything, because nothing will happen. Nothing will happen. And we don't think about it anymore. And so they said, oh, well, that's all right. And he said, you know, I understand you want to get into the forces, but you take your time, and you're not 20. When you're 20, you will be in anyway. And I thought, yes, well, that's what I don't want. I mean, 1 year is not at home is not really going to help terribly much with father so ill. And but I felt awful about it. I was very unhappy, but I thought, well, and it's no good being unhappy. This is not going to help. And of course, on Easter, it was Easter week of 1943. The phone rang about 9 o'clock in the morning, and it's the Inter-Services Research Bureau from London. Yes, Miss Hadfield, we are offering you an appointment here, and we would like you to start on the Tuesday after Easter. So all I said was, but I've nowhere to live. Practical. And she said, well, are you going to accept? And I did. And then, of course, the fireworks went up. And Father said, well, it's ridiculous. So Mother, as usual, practiced, and she saw that I was determined to go. She said, I will go with Elizabeth. We will stay in London together for a couple of nights. We will find somewhere for her to live. And if this job is impossible, she will come home. And that was that. So then we started, and Mother started ringing up all her friends who knew anything about London. And because this was my impression, and later on was that the Ministry of Defence or the War Office, they didn't help at all. They really didn't help in any way. I mean, I think the woman had said, oh, there's the Helena Club. You can stay at that. So, not knowing where the Helena Club was. Anyway, the point was, Mother and I went, and we had the address of the Helena Club, which someone had given us, and we had an address of, I don't know how it came, of a Scottish lady who took PGs who were doing war work and who lived in Hampstead. We had those two addresses, and we went and we stayed at Brown's Hotel, which was all blacked out and very gloomy, like its name. The great bomb, the large bombing had stopped, of course, but there was sporadic bombing. But there was nothing while we were there. And Mother said, well, let us go and go to see this Mrs. MacArthur in Hampstead, because she has a room. She telephoned her. She has a room available, a small room, and she takes PGs who are doing war work, because her husband is at sea. He's a sea captain, and she has a big flat and feels that she must do her war work. So up we went. She's very Scottish, Mrs. MacArthur. It was up five, it was an old Victorian building, five floors up and at the top. And from the top lounge, you had the most wonderful view looking right over London, because it was very near the Heath. It was at the top of Frognall. And she was very pleasant and said, showed us the room, which was very small, just a bed and a table, and I don't know if they have a table. I didn't have somewhere to put your clothes. And she says, explained that her daughter was working at the American Embassy. She had a naval officer. She had one room. And she wanted now, she spoke to Mother, and she said, We have, of course, had bombs at times, and we've lost the front window once, but that has been replaced. And we now want to know, I want to know what work Elizabeth's doing. So she turned to me and she said, where are you working? I said, Baker Street. And mother, who'd heard me chattering, I said, it's a bit of the War Office. And Mrs. MacArthur said, I never heard of the War Office in Baker Street. And now that anybody else. Well, first thing in security, which was bad. So I said, I can't, it's secretarial. I'll be speaking French and it's in Baker Street. And she said, you don't know any more about it. I said, not until I start. So she said, well, that'll be all right. I can't remember how, she said, you 3 guineas a week, but that will include breakfast. I do breakfast, an evening meal, if you wish. Of course, I must have your ration book. I have to, there's no lift here, so I have to do the shopping and bring everything up here myself. She was not young. And that is the position. She said, all Drida, my daughter, and the naval officer leave early breakfast, and they leave well before 8 o'clock. I said, well, I didn't know. And she said, but if you're going to Baker Street, you can walk down and get the number two bus. It'll take you direct. So that was it. That's how I got in.
So tell me about your first day.
So when I got there for the first day, she said, well, now I would like you to sign the Official Secrets Act. So I did. And she said, you're going to the French section. You'll be working for Captain Noble. It is not in this building. It is in Norgeby House across the road, which is 96.
What was the name of the house?
Norgeby.
Norgeby
House. Norgeby. Norgeby House. Which I think is still there today. Last time I went past, there were gents' clothing or something in it. But what it is today, I've not been there lately. Norgeby House. And that was that.
What did you think being asked to sign the Official Secrets Act? Did it sort of mean anything to you?
Well,
did they explain what it meant? That
I'm just trying to think. Well, in it, of course, it said, the first thing it said was, you are not a member of the Communist Party. I think you had to say you weren't. And then it said, I can't remember, except that in it there were various things. You will not divulge your work. Or what you are doing.
Did it impress you with the need for being very secret about the work you were going to do?
Well, yes, because I mean I knew so little about it. I mean she'd not given me any clue, and she said she didn't know anything about it. She couldn't tell me anything about it. So I was still in my mind thinking. It was all rather stupid, and I would be going back home in about a week. That was what I thought. Well, this is silly. Anyway, I went across, and we were second floor up, and I was into an office, and this is Captain Noble. And Captain Noble was in British. It was a captain in the British Army. There were two RAF officers there. There was another civilian secretary, and Captain Noble, and then myself, to our RAF officers, and the secretary to Colonel Buckmaster, who was, I was then told, was head of section. So there were three people in uniform and two of us civilian, and Captain Noble then said good morning or something, and said something else, and I thought, you're not English. And it was quite obvious after about half an hour that he was French. However, his George Noble, that was it. And I sat down, and the two RAF officers were very welcome, and this is Buckmaster's secretary, but nobody said anything about what was going on at all. They supposed, I think, that I knew, but I didn't know anything. And one of the RAF officers, taking the mickey out of George Noble, said, well, it's George's first secretary. Hooray, that's nice. And I nearly turned around and said, it's my first job. But I thought I should keep quiet for the moment. And George Noble sort of fiddled about a bit, and then he said, I would like you to type this for me, please. And it was all numbers, alphabetic numbers, dates. There was no sense in it at all, a page. And he said, I want one copy, and I will ask you to go and get it reprinted, and you have to ask them to put it on edible paper. So I said yes, and I looked at it meant nothing, and I said, he said, you won't make a mistake, will you? And I said, I hope not. He said, somebody's life may depend upon it. So I then typed this page, which of course was a schedule for a wireless operator, which I was to learn later. And afterwards I went across to the Buckmaster's secretary, and I said, would you mind checking this with me? And she did. And so then I asked where I was to go to take it to be put on edible paper. And that's how we began. And he was very un-French, very quiet, very unemotional.
This was Captain Noble.
This is Captain Noble. And he realised then that I didn't know, really, I don't know whether he knew or knew nothing, but I didn't know very much. And he said, now look, I give you permission. We have a filing room in here for the section. And I go in, you go in there. If I don't need you to type, you go and take a file. They're all files belonging to agents which have been sent to France. You can pick up what you want and read it. And like that, you will know more about this section than anyone can tell you. The only thing is, this is a section we keep to ourselves. The less you know about other people's work in the building, and the better. So that was the sort of ethos that went through the whole thing. And I thought, that's a queer thing to say. And somebody said to me, oh no, it's very wise. The less you know, the less you can divulge any, and you've got to keep your within the section and not bother what section is below you or above you or anything. You can keep to yourself. So that was it, and so off we went. So I was picking it up quickly, of course. I mean, you know, and what gave me thing was to go and fetch the files, and that was fascinating. I mean, each was was a person who'd either was there in the field, as it was called, the language you used was in the field, it was operational, and it was the life history, how they went to France and how they, etc., etc. And they were very, very, very fascinating, and in and between typing this and typing that and listening to everybody I could listen to. And also talking to people. There were two other civilian secretaries there. They were older than I was, not much, but early 20s, but civilian. And they helped me a great deal because they told me who was head of section, and that there were about 10, I would think not more than 10 officers then, each more or less with a secretary, and they came and they went, but the ones that had officers were basically 9 to 10 officers there. And one after about a couple of weeks, I'm busy getting a file, and I brought one out and put it by my desk because Noble was out, it was Operation Bombproof. I remember that because it was rather a strange end, because our agents, I was to learn, were all after a trade, butcher, baker, candlestick maker, but not that, butcher, baker, tailor, etc. And Bombproof didn't fit in with that lot, but I read it, and it was a Frenchman, French army officer, escaped, tried to get over the Pyrenees, got to the south of France, been recruited from there via Spain, come to England, been sent back as a wireless operator, and the first one to be sent by the French section. And he'd been captured at one stage, but had got back to England. And so I was, this was fascinating stuff. And one of the RAF officers, I forget his name now, he was passing by, and he said, "Well, you're interested in another file?" And I said, "Well, yes, and this is extremely interesting, because it's the first wireless operator that was sent." Which he said, "Don't you know anything about it? You're working for him." And I said, "George Noble." "Yes, that's not his real name. Can't have his real name. His family's in France." And that did throw me. Yes, he was our first wireless operator. Now he's in charge now of the whole of the wireless operators that we're sending. And that you won't see him. He goes down and sees them at Orchard Court, which I then found out was an office used by the section to interview agents. It was at the bottom of Baker Street, and the agents were not supposed to know where the officers were. They did, but they were not. So, and anyway, they never came. They never came to Baker Street. They didn't come to either 64 or 96. If you had to see them, you went to Orchard Court, where there was a man in charge of the flat in his, what they all have in the civil service, his navy blue suit.
End of Reel 3.
Thank you,
Mrs. Elizabeth Small.
Yes. Can we stop a minute? Because I...
Elizabeth Small, Reel 4. Yes, you were telling me about these very interesting people and how George Noble would meet the wireless operators in Orchard Court.
Yes, or where they were being trained. All the agents, wireless or